What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
In the midst of a national wave of legislative and social attacks on the transgender community, a new report is out called Advancing Transgender Justice, Illuminating Trans Lives Behind and Beyond Bars. Joining us to discuss are Kelsey Chestnut, senior researcher with the Vera Institute for Justice and a lead researcher and co-author of the new report. Good morning, Kelsey.
Good morning. Kelsey, thanks for having me. Yes,
thank
good
you
morning.
For being here. Good morning. We're also joining and tell me, is it Kenna or Kena Barnes, the advocacy manager? Kenna, all right, with Black and Pink, an abolitionist organization supporting LGBTQ and HIV-positive prisoners. Kenna partnered with the Vera Institute of Justice on this new report by connecting them to Black and Pink inside members and centering the community throughout the process. Kenna, good morning. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Before we jump into the report, I actually want to take a couple of minutes for you both to tell us a little bit more about your orgs. Kenna, I would like to start with you and Black and Pink National. What is your work?
Yeah, we are a prison abolitionist organization. We serve LGBTQ plus folks and folks who are living with or impacted by HIV. A lot of the work we do really centers the people who are experiencing oppression from these systems. So when they're coming out, we support them with reentry. We support them with connecting to community. When they're inside, we have, you know, newsletters and letter writing and pen pal opportunities. So if anybody wants a pen pal to someone inside, they can go to our website and sign up for that. But just a lot of really community love and care is the center of our organization.
Kelsey, what about the Vera Institute for Justice? What are you all be up to?
So the Vera Institute is a national nonprofit. It was founded in 1961 in New York, and we work to basically end the overcriminalization and mass incarceration of people, particularly people of color, immigrants, and people experiencing poverty. Basically work to transform criminal, legal, and immigration systems. So we want fewer people incarcerated, people released sooner, and everyone behind bars treated with dignity. And we work with directly impacted communities and government leaders to bring about this change.
Thank you both for that. You know, there's a saying in the movement, those that are closest to the problem are the experts at the solution or closest to the solution. And that's one of the themes that was repeated over and over again in both the executive summary and the report, in the way you all gathered the data, which I really appreciated. Kenna, actually, why is it important in this political moment? I mean, it's always important, but particularly right now, to uplift the voices of system-impacted trans people. What are the goals of the report, and how can this report be utilized to inform organizing?
There is a lot of movement in people realizing what's happening behind bars. And then, of course, with the political landscape, with the anti-trans bills. And so I really think that while we're in the height of people understanding and finding out, utilizing this moment to really grab their attention and say, hey, friends, it's a lot worse than we think it is. I always say that if you think what folks have done outside is bad, wait until you hear what the government and the correctional officers are doing inside. It is alarming. So really just grabbing folks while they're paying attention and utilizing the movement of people finding community and people realizing that community is the answer. Abolition is just a fancy word for communities know what's best. So I think the trajectory is there. Why not capture the moment, you know?
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's my new favorite definition of abolition. So thank you for that. Kelsey, can you talk about the process of getting the information and perhaps the difficulty of being able to access transgender folks in prisons and about how many of the folks that participated were in solitary confinement?
Sure. So in order to conduct this project, you know, we wanted to And we wanted to center the directly impacted folks. And so in previous work that Vera has done with different correction systems across states, and typically we have partnered either with the DOC in order to gain access. It's really, really hard to gain access into these institutes. And you typically need DOC approval in order to conduct any research or to access in any way incarcerated populations. So it's really important to us for this work to take a different approach. And we partnered with Black and Pink at the outset. And the way that we determined who we would be contacting as potential participants for the survey was to work with Black and Pink around their membership and their contact list and to contact people directly through that way. This was for a couple of reasons. One, to gain access, and two, to protect the identity of people who may not have been out in the systems that they were incarcerated in. So the data collection phase of this took place over 2 years. And that's due to the scale of the survey. It was a national survey. And so when you're trying to conduct, when you're trying to reach people who are incarcerated across multiple states, you run into delays based on mail. People are moved. The mail is monitored. So sometimes the mail doesn't get through to people. And so for a number of reasons and for bureaucratic approvals and administrative reasons, it just takes a long time to do any kind of research with people who are currently incarcerated. On top of that, this project took place over the height of COVID. And so that also restricted access completely to people who are currently incarcerated. So data collection occurred over between 2021 and 2022. We used regular mail to get in touch with people who might be interested in participating. We sent a lengthy survey to everyone that was that we determined was eligible on Black and Pink's mailing list. So the survey was very lengthy. It included 92 closed and open-ended questions about a wide range of topics. And so people and people also responded with really extensive responses describing their experiences. And just we also just want to say how grateful we are to get that people took the time to thoughtfully respond to the survey. And they often shared really sensitive and traumatic stories. People responded to us. We provided self-addressed, pre-addressed envelopes, and people responded via mail. And we asked them, to remain confidential, knowing that the mail will be going through, the monitoring that it would typically is subject to in prisons. Right. Our participants, we did ask about housing in solitary. And so our participants reported 89% of them had been in solitary at some point during their incarceration, which the frequency, my previous work was in solitary confinement reform, and the prevalence and frequency of solitary is higher than most people expect, just that more people are experience solitary than what's really usually thought of as something that's reserved for the most serious crimes or the most extreme situations. But even in that, with that background, 89% having had that experience is really, really high. And at the time of the survey, about 22% of our respondents, when they received the survey and responded, they were in solitary at the time that they took the survey. So that's about 1 in 5 of our respondents were in solitary at that time.
You segued a little bit to where I wanted to go next. Kenna, the United Nations defines solitary confinement as torture. We know that even a few hours of it impacts the brain and sensory functions. We also know, as Kelsey was just pointing out, prisons across the U.S. keep people in solitary confinement. This can be for weeks, months, and years. We just had an elder come home that spent 33 years in solitary confinement. My understanding is that for trans folks, and please correct me if I'm wrong, in many cases, they are put in solitary confinement, and sometimes it's said that they're being put there for their own protection. Often, however, it's just punishment, bigotry in motion. Can you talk about the specific mental and emotional impact for trans folks locked away in solitary?
I mean, I think we forget that people inside are humans, and we all experienced COVID. Being alone and being isolated is really, really hard. And experiencing that when you are navigating your gender, I think about, 53% of our participants were denied gender-affirming meds. So the impact of navigating your gender and your mental health goes down significantly when you go inside, just period. So navigating all of those barriers at the start and then getting put into a cell that doesn't have light often, that doesn't have any of your things. It doesn't have any human qualities or aspects to it, is just terrible. So people write to us a lot who are in solitary, and it's, you can see people who write to us continuously, you can see their handwriting change. And it hurts my heart to say that, you know, like you can see the mental and physical degrade in just their handwriting. So I think a very small portion of our population actually does probably need to be removed from their community. And I still don't believe that they should be in prison. And I still especially do not believe that they should be isolated like that. Again, we forget that we're all humans. And when folks, we came out of COVID different. We came out different. And that was still not the extent of what solitary is for folks inside. And trans folks, again, having more oppression equals disproportionate amount of mental health and physical health problems. So those really arise quickly.
Thank you, Kenna. Kelsey, one of the buckets that the report addresses is housing inside of prisons. How does that reality around solitary confinement inform recommendations that are made about housing inside of prisons in this report?
Sure. So, as Kenna was saying, solitary is just really harmful for everybody. And for some of our respondents, they did report that they would opt in or get themselves in solitary, but as a last resort, that was one safety strategy when there are no other options. And that's something that we've heard in other from other work that we've done as well, is that in a situation where you're given two terrible options, either solitary is the only protective housing unit or imminent risk of sexual assault or some other threat, those are the two choices that you'd be weighing. So to try and make a choice around their safety. But in that context, most of our respondents, what they really want is some say in their housing generally. And that is with either who they are being celled with or on the type of unit that they're on. And that if other options existed, that they would not be choosing this whatsoever. In fact, nearly 80% of our respondents said they would prefer to live in a unit for trans people or among other LGBTQ+ people.
Continuing to talk about housing, can you talk about the recommendations in terms of which facilities people are placed in and the ways in which the state often does not honor the gender of the person who's being incarcerated?
Sure. So our respondents, again, did say that basically that they're not a monolith. There is no one size fits all policy or one size, where everyone should be housed. And one of the main recommendations of the overall theme is to listen to people and that they know what's best for them and that they would like some meaningful input in where they're going to be housed. And again, that goes against it. Everything in prison settings to have any kind of choice, but that is the resounding theme from our participants. Among our participants, two-thirds of the trans women in our study who were mostly in prisons designated for men said they would prefer to be in prisons designated for women. But there was that, about a third who would wish to remain in prisons designated for men. So again, it's not a monolith, and people, depending on their situation and what state they're in, and a whole list of other reasons that Kenna could probably speak to better, that people want some input into where they're going to be housed.
Kenna, what would you like to add?
I think that autonomy is a really big thing. Kelsey mentioned that the prisons, that's the goal of the prison, is to not have autonomy, to not have an identity. So any autonomy that folks can have inside is really important, but housing, that's your entire life. If you're there for quite a bit of time, even if you're there for a short amount of time, that's a significant portion of your experience is where you're housed. And people find safety in different ways. People find community in different ways. And so I really see those statistics and the need for autonomy as an expression of, this is where I find community. Some folks really feel safer when they're around people who share their identities. Some people don't. And I think anybody who is queer and trans, our community, we all have, you know, internalized things. We're all raised in America with, you know, biases and misogyny and sexism and transphobia and da 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 da, that might impact those things. And those things are even more intense inside. And so how people can find safety, how people can find community, is through housing often.
That was another thread in the report that I want to tug on. And that was about the importance of social relationships, right? The need for connectivity. Can you talk about what the survey and report uplifted about that, Kelsey?
Sure. So as you mentioned, that was one of the major themes that we highlighted in our report. And it was talked about by our respondents in kind of two ways, that, you know, the two sides to it, where people experience, you know, their experiences both to the exposure to social interactions, set some ways that would be really supportive, and that it was also the social environment in some ways that could be posing a threat. As Kenna mentioned, you know, individuals are going to feel safety or be at risk for different things. There's different ways that community looks and support looks, and what would be important to people. So for our respondents, you know, they did report that they relied on their social relationships that were supportive and protective in some cases. And, you know, the majority did not find this at all among prison staff. They talked, there were some individual officers that were highlighted, but for the vast majority of our respondents, they talked about supportive relationships with other incarcerated people and outside organizations and loved ones as a key way that they said they feel safer inside. And when I say supportive relationships with other incarcerated people, it was stressed to us that that was, you know, platonic and romantic, not always romantic relationships, but just that social community was a very supportive relationship. And about 30% of our respondents said that they had supportive relationships inside, and about 65% said that they have people outside who support them. So that outside support is really, really crucial for our respondents.
The romantic relationships, those are often criminalized, correct, inside of prisons, Kenna?
Yeah, they sure are. And they use PREA in the same way that they do with trans and queer folks or folks living with HIV. PREA is the Prison Rape Elimination Act. So that is utilized as a form of punishment frequently. So they utilize that policy to keep folks separated and to keep them away from their romantic partners or their friends, or lots of folks are criminalized for just holding hands. So it is not great, not a great policy.
I'm watching the clock, and I want to get to this last bucket that we're going to talk about today, and that is around gender-affirming healthcare. Kelsey, can you talk about the realities inside of prison and what the survey found?
Sure. So that was one area that was highlighted again by our respondents is some it was their mental and healthcare, and particularly around gender-affirming healthcare. Most of our respondents reported that, you know, they had access to care, but that it could be improved, but that in terms of their gender-affirming healthcare, most of the respondents did not feel that their practitioners were knowledgeable around specific issues related to gender-affirming care, or that they didn't have key access to it. 3 in 5 of our respondents reported that they were taking medication before they were incarcerated. And so they reported there was a barrier, you know, barriers to continue to access that care while inside. And one of the recommendations that came from our respondents is that they wanted increased access to accessories and rules around appearance, excuse me, to be similar in facilities that were designated for men's and women's, for men and women. So, you know, rules around facial hair or shaving or the length of your hair, that they should be the same, no matter what facility, designation it is. And, around gender affirming care, people also said that they wanted authorities and staff to allow changes in and respect for, you know, pronouns and names, as part of, their gender affirming care.
Ken, I'm going to give you the last word here. What would you like to add?
I'd just really like to add that if we want to abolish prisons, we have to do a lot of work on the outside. We are experiencing all of the things that they've experienced for a long time, and they experience it quite more intensely. And so really a lot of work has to be done for folks to come out and feel safe. We have to figure out how to stop these gender affirming bans, these anti-trans bills. They are dangerous. They are very dangerous. Criminalizing an identity is not a good place for our country to be. So I think people are really realizing that, and realizing that if they are criminalized for being trans, they have to go into these systems that are, I mean, 50 times worse. I don't even know, just a large amount worse within the policy. So I really think making sure we're preparing the world that we want to see outside for folks to come out if we are to really dismantle these systems.
All right, I've got to leave it there. Thank you both so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.